what you have is a potential for an authoritarian response to a crisis that could end up in the end of democracy as we know it in the United States.
The inherent power of the President of the United States to suspend the Constitution or any provisions thereof or any laws of the government when he decides it's in the national interest to do so.
Giuffrida, North, and George Bush began to turn FEMA into an instrument of domestic anti-terrorism.
You're dealing with a group of people in the Reagan administration who equated political dissent with treason and who cannot differentiate between emergency procedures, which I think everyone agrees are necessary, and suppressing political dissent. And with North and Poindexter and Casey, you had a group of people who saw Americans who disagree with them as the enemy.
I was particularly concerned, Mr. Chairman, because I read in Miami papers and several others that there had been a plan developed by that same agency, a contingency plan in the event of emergency that would suspend the American Constitution, and I was deeply concerned about it.
We look at the many laws which adversely affect our constitutional rights, particularly the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA. A lot of these things you don't know about, but we'll tell you right now on Alternative Views. Did you know that with a stroke of a pen or a phone call, all your constitutional rights can be eliminated? The prime movers in the United States power structure admit that capitalism and democracy are not compatible. We're going to talk to a lot of people about these dangers to our civil liberties. First is Chip Berle, who is an author and investigative reporter, particularly about civil liberties. Next, we'll hear from Arthur Kanoy, a member of the National Lawyer Guild and a longtime fighter for civil liberties in the United States. John Stockwell, a former CIA officer, is very aware of the underside, the dark side of U.S. system. Ron Paul, on the Banking Committee of the House of Representatives, was in a good position to see how the system works, as is Congressman Henry Gonzalez from San Antonio, who's also on the House Banking Committee. Former history professor from the University of Texas, Tom Philpott, who will put all of this in an historical perspective. We start with a quote from Ken Lawrence, who is a colleague of Chip Berle. Never before have the political duties of the police on every level been so explicitly articulated, so broadly connected, so well organized. It's not just high technology that has made this possible. It is also the new strategies of the permanent repression. Chip Berle is an investigator and fighter for civil liberties. He's a member of National Lawyer Guild, and he's had a lot of things written, a lot of articles about civil liberties and the Covert Action Information Bulletin, The Nation, the Chicago Sun-Times, and Boston Globe. We're going to talk on this Alternative Views program about how the government, particularly under the Reagan administration, has studied very extensively and intensively U.S. society and figured out how to control it in times of emergency or to prevent times of emergency from coming up. And then the organizations and the framework they have decided upon to use to effect this.
And it's rather scary, but very, very interesting. We have told people and alternative views about the planning organizations when Reagan was governor of California,
right,
where they looked at society and then they came up with these things, and then Reagan took all of his buddies into the national government with him when right. he became president. Can you tell us about how this started and what they did out there? What, CSTA?
It actually is a number of institutions and organizations in California. When Ed Meese was out there, and
Giafrida,
and whose name has come up before, with FEMA, and also Ronald Reagan, of course, was governor. And this was a period of great tumult on the college campuses, and it was during the 60s. And there was a feeling on the part of Governor Reagan that he needed to be able to control anarchy in the streets, literally. And so he empowered his attorney general of the state and his friends and his police force to put together, in conjunction with the military, a series of first exercises called the Lantern Spike Garden Plot. And these were a series of exercises in which the military would come in and assist the civilian government in rounding up anarchists and subversives and people fighting in the streets and detain them and regain control of the state for the state authorities. And these were exercises that were actually tested. Their game, you know, scenarios were written. We obtained these scenarios through a series of both lawsuits and Freedom of Information Act requests. And they are explicitly a scenario operation for the mass arrest and detention of dissidents in the United States. And that's what it says. It says right on the documents that that's what they're planning.
Is it possible that our government could do this sort of thing? Mm-hmm. Could our leaders, mm-hmm. could this lovable, friendly president mm-hmm. be capable of doing this sort of thing? You have to go back to the Vietnam days when President Reagan was then governor of California and see what his policies were and what he did. He did call out the National Guard. Students were in fact shot. Remember his famous statement in 1970 when he was asked about the anti-war protests on campuses, and he said, if there has to be a bloodbath, let's get it over with. And then to make sure that people understood that he was tough and he meant it, 3 days later he said it again. If there has to be a bloodbath, let's get it over with. Now think about this. A leader of this country who is seriously proposing a bloodbath of our own young people.
Also, there then began set up training programs. That, like you mentioned, CSTI was a California Specialized Training Institute. There was also set up something called the Law Enforcement Intelligence Unit. CSTI, what it did was it taught local police how to deal with dissidents. And its worldview is that of the far right, of reactionary authoritarianism, in which anyone who voiced dissenting opinions was a potential violent terrorist, essentially.
What I found fascinating about your analysis of the philosophy of these groups is that they assumed a state of warfare.
Yes.
That they were applying these counterinsurgency techniques
right.
that were developed in Northern Ireland and Vietnam and other parts of the world to U.S. society. They were assuming that U.S. society was at war, and that anyone that opposed the Vietnam process, program of intervention in Vietnam was an enemy of
right.
the state and thus should be dealt with one, and that they should use intelligence groups to do
sure.
surveillance of these organizations, they should infiltrate them, and they should destroy them
right.
as part of an enemy apparatus.
Let's get back to this California Specialized Training
sure.
Institute, because to me that is such a... It isn't just pure ideology we're talking about. They made a very realistic appraisal of American society, actually a very Marxian appraisal of American society. And their Giuffrida's course and his publication that they used in studying it called Civilian Violence and Terrorism.
The most powerful weapon of a revolutionary is the silent, accumulating contempt and hatred of a people directed at the government or another segment of the class structure. This thesis is magnified considerably when the form of government is capitalistic, and class-ridden. CSTI textbook.
They looked at American society and said, okay, this is a society which is the upper class which rules and the lower classes get screwed. And they don't like it.
With the exception of the mentally deranged or the intoxicated person, all acts of illegal criminal violence have roots somewhere in our present social, economic, or political environment.
And it's a racist society. And the people of color get screwed, and they don't like it.
The racially segregated segments have emerged with periods of sporadic violence. So long as the white man remains superior in numbers, he will be the repressor and the constant target of the mad dog. For these minority elements, any steps to prevent violence which do not address the issues of fundamental social and political change are destined to be irrelevant and fated to failure.
It's a patriarchal society, and the women are getting the short end of the stick, and they don't like it, so they're going to struggle. So, because there are so many dissatisfied people having good reason to be dissatisfied, that means these people will try to better their condition.
Legitimate violence is integral to our form of government, for it is from this source that we can continue to purge our weaknesses. Illegal violence has roots which are attached to emotional situations of political, economic, or social inequality.
That means that the government we are and society and the ruling class will have constant competition and people struggling against it, so there is permanent insurgency. And because there is permanent insurgency, we need to have permanent state oppression. Boy, when I read that, it just...
Actually, what they said is you have to have permanent counterinsurgency, which can take the form of state repression when necessary. And because no one wants to get up in the morning and look in the mirror and say, let's go out and repress dissent today. You know, they have to characterize it in terms that they can internalize and live with. Like, it's important to understand that, because people don't get up in the morning and say, well, I'm an FBI agent and I have to ensure that the oligarchic economic interests of America succeed once again in screwing the masses. Because, you know, you're not going to do that. The average person isn't going to do that.
But when the people who are the prime people in this organization look at society, they look at it very realistically.
Oh, sure.
Now, then they can go out with
this
their ideology
internal,
from them.
Right, this is internal consumption, right?
But they're looking at society, and then they say...
Well, that's an accurate appraisal of American society.
Right, right. Absolutely, and they're looking... That's what's scary. They're looking at this American society very realistically, and then they come up with these ways to have repression of the people who are struggling to get a better...
To normalize it.
And to get a bigger share of the prize.
What's different here, though, and this is where Ken Lawrence and I sometimes disagree, but it's a disagreement over 1% of... whereas we agree on 99%, is the character of this understanding different, and thus are the techniques different, or is this merely a continuation? Ken, I think, says that it's a new state repression, as he says in his articles, where the understanding that this permanent state of insurgency requires a permanent state of counterinsurgency has changed the battle. I'm not so sure. There's evidence on both sides of this, and I don't think it really matters, and we're sort of fiddling over hairs here. What I say is that if you look at the Monty Maguires as a paradigm, I mean, what you had there were the mine owners seeing a permanent state of insurgency and thus putting in permanent counterinsurgency people into them to provoke violence and then round up the people who they trapped.
As early as the 1880s or?
Oh yeah, in the 1800s, definitely, right. As early as, and you see similar things going on. I can go back to the Bible and talk about slipping people into the city to see what's going on, you know. However, I think Ken has a good point that what happened in an industrialized society, in a global economy, is that this took on a new character in terms of technique. And this, I agree with him wholeheartedly, that the techniques that began to be used were much more sophisticated than merely putting agents and informants in place and putting in agents or provocateurs.
And what they said was that analyzing the 50s, 60s struggles and all, they said that the problems that they had then was that they let these groups and organizations go too far.
Right.
They didn't try to repress them until they were actually coherent, cogent, active groups struggling for change. They said, we've got now to destroy these organizations and the leaders before they can actually
preemptive
start to sort of a preemptive strike
Absolutely.
On democratic dissent. Right.
Absolutely.
Here's what a speaker at a FEMA conference in 1984 had to say. The proper response of a democratic government to terrorist violence is to crush it by force, exercised in a confident, measured, but thoroughly remorseless manner. And here's what Ronald Reagan said at a cable splicer conference. There are some people in this state who, if they could see this gathering right now, in my presence here, would decide their worst fears and convictions have been realized. I was planning a military takeover.
When Reagan was elected to the presidency, he installed Louis Giafrida as head of FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Giafrida was an old cold warrior from Reagan's California days whose specialty was suppression of unrest and dissent.
Louis Giafrida, who's a friend of Ed Meese from California, who likes to be called general, although he was never a general in any military organization, he lobbies, he lectures, he goes on television, he's openly demanding legislation that would create, give him the power so that in time of national emergency, he can go in and declare martial law, and he advocates martial law, and he can lay a curfew on a town and put the National Guard on street corners and shoot people down in the streets. He is openly advocating this, and he's not talking about doing it in Nicaragua or El Salvador. He's talking about doing it in our country.
Martial law shifts control from civilians to the military completely. And without the necessity of a declaration, proclamation, or other form of public manifestation. Martial rule is limited only by the principle of necessary force. Louis Giafrida.
The structures then that flow out of the California period, and I think you're right to focus on the California period because it was a test lab for these new repressive technologies.
And the same people went to Washington.
Well, that's right. I mean, not only was it a paradigm, but it was an airplane flight. I mean, these people flew into Washington when Reagan got elected, and they had set up this whole superstructure, training programs, scenarios, a view of the world that was coherently based on this paranoid view of the, I call it the onion ring theory of domestic dissent, you know, because if you keep peeling away the layers of honest people, you find a commie inside, you know. That what happened is that they simply, now that they had the power to implement this on a national scale, they did so.
Giafrida, North, and George Bush began to turn FEMA into an instrument of domestic anti-terrorism.
You're dealing with a group of people in the Reagan administration who equated political dissent with treason and who cannot differentiate between emergency procedures, which I think everyone agrees are necessary, and suppressing political dissent. And with North and Poindexter and Casey, you had a group of people who saw Americans who disagree with them as the enemy.
Alexander Coburn in These Times reports that Giafrida attended the Army War College in 1970 and there wrote a paper advocating martial law in the case of a uprising by black militants, along with roundup and transfer to assembly centers of relocation camps, at least 21 million American Negroes. This paper was the basis for part of this FEMA program of the Reagan administration.
Actually, FEMA had been set up by Carter.
Yeah, Carter set it up just for you know, to take care of emergencies.
Like hurricanes or big
wars, something like this. But the Reaganites came in there and they installed there.
They brought Giafrida from California.
Yeah, right. With his worldview.
Right. And so what did they do? What did FEMA set up? And now what is the status today?
Well, what they set up was a series of structures for emergency management being localized outside of either the control of Congress or, in fact, the executive branch as a unit. And they set up a parallel structure to manage society in the case of a crisis, which did not necessarily have to react to the input of Congress or necessarily react to the input of the president, but could have actually be a person not the president and not responding to Congress, could then take over emergency management of a county, a city, a state, or in fact the whole country. Fairly authoritarian worldview here operating, and that the means of doing this was achieved through a series of laws and executive orders that were passed, first proposed as a package and rejected as much too authoritarian, and then simply slipped through one at a time in different bills.
The Spotlight has a 8-page special on the whole aspect of this, and it says that what FEMA has done is to set up a parallel government, and all these people are trained, and people at the state and local levels are trained also, and particularly the police organizations. But people are trained so that when the president gives the word, and of course all he has to do is give the word, he doesn't have to get congressional approval. If he says it's a national emergency, then they have things set up so that they actually go in and they will run the various departments in the executive branch.
Well, it'll be the military to do this. I have some information on this, Frank, that was published in these times, that somehow got hold of the Department of Defense directive that was put out by this Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, that Oliver North helped to write up. And the Pentagon document states, in those areas in which martial law has been proclaimed, military resources may be used for local law enforcement. Normally, a state of martial law will be proclaimed by the president. However, in the absence of such action by the president, a senior military commander may impose martial law in an area of his command where there has been a complete breakdown in the exercise of government functions by local civilian authorities. Military assumption of judicial law enforcement and administrative functions of local government will be based on necessity, this actual and present, and the performance of these functions will continue only so long as the necessity of that extreme nature requires interim military intervention. If there was a nuclear war, or if there was, say, an invasion of Central America and there was protest by the people against that, a national emergency could be proclaimed, and this FEMA Act would make it possible for the military to take over local government, to take over the courts, to take over the media, to set up concentration camps for all of the protesters against the current government policy, and to in effect have martial law in the country. The author of this directive was Frank Carlucci, who is now Reagan's national security advisor, and of course Oliver North.
Under any type of emergency, they would be able to arrange for the succession to office and emergency organization of departments and agencies. In other words, they determine who would be running the government. They would determine which governments, which people both in and out of government would have the access to shelters in the case of war. And so you got to have a buddy of FEMA if you want to live. And they would also coordinate the federal activities concerning international civil emergency planning. Well, of course, under Reagan, this became much more sinister. And like you say, all of this training which they had done in California. But there's another sinister aspect of this, too. Sounds like the Soviet Union. The Department of Health and Human Services would set up mental health centers where citizens considered deranged or overly upset might be confined at the pleasure of the president. But what this is the Spotlight goes on and say they're actually people who are trained so that they can move in and take over the civilians as well as in using the military so they can actually have a complete coup.
And that's the crisis we face now.
That's their response to these turmoils of the people and the actions of the people that you're talking.
And what they are doing now is they are re-experimenting with an abandonment of the elementary principles of the Constitution and replacing it by what? Let's face it. What are they replacing it by? They're replacing it by totalitarian rule of the master up there.
So it gives the president totalitarian powers to suspend the Constitution, to violate anyone's right whenever the president deems it's necessary.
And what I discovered a lot of people throughout the country don't know is that Reagan and Bush sent Oliver North to FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, to do a memorandum as to what they should do in case of an emergency where a lot of people in this country would not agree with their engaging in military activities.
Like an invasion
like
in
an invasion or anywhere in the world.
Right.
And what do, and he writes out, and this was in, as you know, the Miami Herald.
Right.
During the Iran-Contra hearings.
July 5th, 1987.
That the president should issue an order, and in so many words, and when I saw that for the first time, I couldn't believe it. Suspending the Constitution of the United States. Suspending the Congress and replacing it with a military government. Suspending local and state legislatures. Suspending the courts and replacing them with military tribunals and establishing detention camps throughout the country in which any person who didn't agree with this proclamation would be thrown in.
Yeah. And what's even worse, it isn't just a decision of the president. They've delegated that, they have provisions to delegate this authority to local commanders and police authorities so
exactly.
that they can suspend civil liberties on a local basis.
On a local level, whenever they want to.
I think one of the most key elements of it is nationalizing, in essence, the National Guard and taking away control of the National Guard in a time of emergency from the governor, who is, of course, responding to an electorate, and placing the control directly into the military, who is not responding to either Congress or the president, but potentially a group of emergency managers in some little bunker someplace who take control of America in the name of Congress and the presidency until things are back under control.
Now, there's scenarios
which
where
is a little bit like Dr. Strangelove.
Right, exactly,
recall,
where the military would take over. And in fact, their scenarios were nuclear war, that after a nuclear war,
right.
you would need some group to try to get production
right.
organized or save
right.
lives, et cetera. But
well, that was under Carter. Yeah,
that was the yeah. theory of
this,
the real.
This yeah, was the origin
right.
of this.
Right.
But they also talked about national emergencies
right.
during the Central America era, where there was
right.
talk about invasion of Nicaragua, where there would be dissent, as
yes.
there was in Vietnam, and then the president could declare a national emergency,
right.
and they could round up dissidents
that's
and
correct.
Literally put them in concentration camps
right.
that were named and localized.
What's important
well, this was under the this was they already had this
that's
under
saying,
the American
nothing new
under the McCarran Act.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
this was different in that it delegated this authority to come in and put people in concentration camps and declare martial law to the local level.
Yeah.
I mean,
that was the key to how horrible it was, is that there was no one who was responding to an electorate had control over this decision-making. It was a group of managers, you know, micromanagers and macromanagers were going to move in and decide that your city is too riotous, we're going to shut it down and take care of business and we'll give it back to you and things are back under control. Well, that's, you know, pretty scary. Pretty scary construct.
And then any local police authority or army or military authority can say, hey, I don't want, like, what's happening in this town? Okay. There we are.
Sign an order.
Right. That's right.
But they did have a national organization of FEMA. They had an office
it was
outside
based
of Berryville,
yeah.
Virginia, I think.
That's correct.
That had a little village that would manage things
right.
in case
in
of
case
a national of emergency. And we have no idea who these people were, what
right.
their plans were.
They certainly didn't appear in front of Congress and justify themselves because they couldn't.
Right.
Because if they ever did, people would go nuts.
It was a top secret,
right.
Really neo-fascist authoritarian military.
What's fascinating is during the Iran-Contra hearings is when Representative Brooks tried to bring this up and he was silenced,
right.
bipartisan
yeah.
silent.
Right.
I mean, everyone said, oh, you know, we don't talk about these things, you know, because it's too important to keep this quiet.
Colonel North, in your work at the NSC, were you not assigned at one time to work on plans for the continuity of government in the event of a major disaster?
Mr. Chairman.
I believe the question touches upon a highly sensitive and classified area, so may I request that you not touch upon that, sir?
I was particularly concerned, Mr. Chairman, because I read in Miami papers and several others that there had been a plan developed by that same agency, a contingency plan in the event of emergency that would suspend the American Constitution. And I was deeply concerned about it and wondered if that was the area in which he had worked. I believe that it was.
I most respectfully request that that matter not be touched upon at this stage. If we wish to get into this, I'm certain arrangements can be made for an executive session.
They immediately suppress it, and they say, this is something we can't discuss in the open.
Yes.
People aren't allowed to know about this.
Yeah.
And that's why, who protected this information? Who protected Oliver North? The head Democrat, which goes to show you the power structure is the same.
With respect to Brooks challenging North or asking him about these residual standby plans, which have been in existence for some time, but which are more proximate to us today as a result of a national security advisory that President Reagan signed in May of 1984, and which, of course, is by its very nature under the coverage of security, and you could be hauled up and brought in by the FBI and charged with espionage if you were to reveal any knowledge as to the exact content of that document. But there's no question that it was patterned after what was talked about during the Watergate crisis. At that time, there were standby powers. General Haig at that time was the one in which there were such things seriously discussed as the suspension of the national elections in 1974, or rather 72. If there were turbulence and disorder throughout the country that would prevent an orderly process, well, who's going to determine that? Once you do that, then it's possible to invoke such things as military.
If the American people knew how loose this has become, I mean, you always need scenarios for a disaster.
Right.
And you know, our government would be ill-serving us if they didn't prepare these scenarios. But when you bring into these scenarios domestic dissent as a provocateur of this being implemented, then we're talking about a level of political repression that I don't think Congress would tolerate if the people knew about it. But they don't know about it because, of course, it's a matter of national security that we don't talk about it, therefore we got to trust them. Well, trust them? I mean, they don't have a very good track record in some of these agencies for trust.
Or why would a government be against civil liberties? It's hard to imagine that they would assault, you know, our very Constitution, our very basic liberties.
This is not just an attack on the constitutional protections of the rights, the emancipated peoples and of the peoples of color. This is an attack on every single constitutional right of every person. The right not to be have your home broken into, the right not to be stopped on a highway and searched and frisked without a warrant, the violations of the Fourth Amendment, the protections of the First Amendment, the protections of the right to counsel. They have a conscious effort to weaken and undermine every one of these rights. And what is beginning to develop, and people are beginning to see this, the power structure, not only in the government, but in the big corporations, they are very frightened. And what are they frightened at? That millions and millions of people in this country are angry and suffering from the most elementary problems that they have, which are not being solved. One of the most shocking examples, and I'm sure you have some of this down here in Texas, I've been at many meetings all through the Midwest, of whom the family farmers, hundreds of thousands of family farmers are facing what? The worst crisis in their lives, the farm mortgage foreclosure crisis, in which the big banks are coming in, and they're open about it. They've decided that we don't need family farms any longer in this country, that we must have what is known as what? Corporate agriculture.
Right.
And they will be destroyed. All right, the family farmers, and we must understand this, they are not long-haired radicals.
Right.
They are what we've always known as the heart of middle America. And what are they saying? They're in meetings all over. They are furious. And why? Because they went to the White House. They demanded what? What their grandparents got from a certain president known as Franklin Roosevelt. The first thing, and I was a youngster at that time. I didn't even remember this, but I'll never forget an older farmer saying this to me at a meeting in Kansas. that his father had told him that the first thing that Franklin Roosevelt had done when he was elected was to sign a presidential decree declaring a four-year moratorium on farm foreclosures, right, giving the family farmers right, a chance to move forward, and they were saved. All right, they went to Washington during the Reagan period, and then again the first this year of the Bush administration, and you know what they were told by Reagan and Bush? Go home. We don't have any right to interfere with banks. We don't have any right, we don't have any power to do this. So the family farmers are furious, and what are they looking for? For the first time, they want to work together with what? Millions of people, and many of them across the state line from them, who are facing what? The crisis of plant closings. Hundreds of thousands, millions of American people.
Workers.
Working people. And many of them white working people, many of them people of color, are faced with devastation. And I don't have to tell you folks down here. You take a look, you go into anywhere along the Ohio River, for example, where the steel plants were first developed, and you go into some of these cities, and what does it look like? London looked like after the bombings in World War II, because the plants are all closed down, and the business people, the small business people are destroyed, there's no market, and they're furious, and they're trying to come together, and what are they demanding? Very elementary demand. If these companies close our plants, we must have the right to run them ourselves. We must have the right to take them over. And the state of Pennsylvania, as a result of this pressure from the majority of its people, passed a bill setting up a plant closing agency that had the power under, again, a technical legal word that nobody understands, called eminent domain, right, coming yeah, from where? Coming from the Middle Ages in England, right, that a town has the power to take over property which injures the interests of the people of the town. And they want to take it over, and what are the big corporations doing? They're going into court, and they're charging that what? This is Bolshevism. This is un-Americanism. We have the right not only to own a plant, to close a plant. Period. All right. So the plant, the family farmers are saying, we can't win by ourselves. It's true. The plant closing people can't win by themselves, the working people, the union people. But if we get together, we have a fighting chance. And then what are they saying? We want to get together. And they've asked for meetings now, and this is making American history, meetings with representatives of the black movements all through the South who are facing, as folks all through the South know,
homelessness, poverty,
and redistricting, losing the right to vote. Then you take in the urban areas of the North, what's the most serious problems? I don't know whether you have it down here.
Drugs.
Housing. Homelessness. And then the drug crisis from one end of the country to the other. So people getting together. Take the women's movement. Women are furious. Because what? The same Supreme Court in June came down with a decision which put the knife in to what had been decided in Roe against Wade as the fundamental right of women to make decisions over their own lives, their own bodies, the right to abortion. And so the women are saying, we've got to do something about this. And not only the right to abortion, the right of women not to have sexual harassment in a job.
Right, right.
Which I don't have to tell you folks, that's one of the most current phenomena in our society, that women have this experience in factories and in employment and everything else. So if you add together all of these groups and they unite to fight for what? All kinds of radical changes, nonsense, to fight for their immediate
survival,
what will that mean? And the folks in the power structure, the industrial military complex, and that's not a radical term. You know who that was first
Dwight
used
Eisenhower.
By? Eisenhower.
Right. Yeah.
First used that term, all right? If all of these folks come together and fight for their immediate needs, then the power of the industrial military complex is threatened. And we will have a change. We have a new type of government, a new type of government representing the needs and interests of the people. And the power structure is scared to death about this.
Right.
And that's why they are saying that What do these people do? They'll use these elementary constitutional rights to organize. They'll use it to come together. They'll use it to fight for their rights. Therefore, a moment has come when we have to get rid of these rights. And what are they putting forward? And I lived through this in the Nixon period because I was thrown right into this fight in the Supreme Court of the United States. Little concept known as what? The inherent power of the President of the United States to suspend the Constitution or any provisions thereof or any laws of the government when he decides it's in the national interest to do so. And they're putting that forward once again?
That what happened is that they simply, now that they had the power to implement this on a national scale, they did so. Primarily through the Federal Emergency Management Administration with a series of steps that were first rejected, I might add, under Nixon. Some of these theories were first promulgated under Nixon and first promulgated when Reagan first came to office, and Congress rejected the packages of legislation. What has happened, however, is that almost every single element of this repressive apparatus that was first scenarioized in California has been passed into law by Congress on a piecemeal basis, so that you have change of authority set up and structures set up and detention camps set up and plans for, instead of the National Guard reporting to the governor of the state, the National Guard now becomes militarized. The establishment of state defense forces, which are nothing more than armed vandals of our society being empowered to enforce the law. What a great idea, you know. Every gun nut in America now is part of the strategic, you know, this state defense force movement.
And they're being organized.
And they're being organized and trained.
So, loonies, the craziest people in the Reagan administration were involved in formulating these plans, and we still don't even know.
Well, but see, now, interestingly enough, given the way society functions, a lot of these people were moved out. They sort of lost a power struggle for control of this apparatus, in part because some people in government thought they were too lunatic. That's the good news. The bad news is the apparatus remains, and it's in somebody's hands, and we don't know who really now is the agency or agencies or administrators who are, in fact, in control of this apparatus that has been set up. What's important to know is that the apparatus exists. It still exists today, and therefore we are dependent on the goodwill of who is at the controls of this apparatus.
But it's no longer in FEMA. Giofredo was
not clear
forced
where
to resign
he was forced to
in
resign
1985.
Over power struggle, over this very issue.
But FEMA still exists. Whenever there's the earthquake or the floods.
Well, they don't do a very good job with earthquake and floods.
You saw them in the news.
Yeah.
I had some of my students do some research into FEMA. So they went through databases.
You noticed how their funding works, how much is for natural disaster and how much is for just sort of stuff.
Right. It was only a small percentage.
Small percentage is for natural disaster.
But is it certain that they no longer have these secret plans?
Oh, they still have the plans. They're still, the structure within FEMA exists, but the people who were running the show, like Giofredo, have been moved out, and it's not clear whether it's NSC or a bizarre Department of the Veterans Administration because of National Guard and Reserve duty, or it's not clear if it's in the Pentagon. I mean, it's sort of like somebody robbed a bank and took the money, and they caught the bank robbers and put them in jail, but no one's going to tell you where the money is. You know, it's like they've dealt with half the problem. They got rid of the people who designed the system, but somebody's still in control of the system, and that's what we have to find out. And people like Dr. Reynolds and others are trying to unravel that now, and it's a difficult task because, of course, national security
doesn't
allow you
to blow the whistle.
Someone needs to blow the whistle here.
Say where it's gone and what the plans are.
Right. We know they're still there. We just don't know who's running the show.
Interesting.
Well, there are also a lot of these things could be dealt with through national security directives, which are secret.
Now, what they are setting up is a new bevy of laws, 15 or so, but there's more than 15, national laws, Supreme Court precedents, programs being prepared that will create a new situation in the next war so that the public will not have the full access to the truth of what's happening, and then so that dissidents can be controlled, so that people can't make their political weight felt by taking to the streets, by demonstrating. Some of these, just to mention a few of them, for example, you have the Marchetti and Snep rulings of the Supreme Court, which gives the government the right to censor books before publication. In the Snep case, they didn't accuse him of revealing any secrets. They just claimed that he had an unauthorized disclosure of the government's activities. And for that, they took away $100,000 from him in a civil suit.
Even though it was even unclassified.
Even though it was unclassified, yeah. There were no secrets involved.
And now a broader range of government employees is under these restrictions.
Oh, yeah, the Morrison, the criminal case against Morrison, who leaked some information to Jane's weapon systems, they're going after this guy under the espionage law. And if they get this, if President Reagan gets this, anybody who talks to the press in Washington could be jailed for espionage. Another one is the Phil A.G. passport ruling, in which the Supreme Court supported the State Department. The Secretary of State now has the authority to take away any American citizen's passport without a hearing. It means that in the next war, a Jane Fonda going to Hanoi, a Cy Hirsch covering My Lai, they'll just lose their passport. And My Lai won't be exposed. Another law that they're putting together, which is as ominous as you can get, is this preemptive strikes against terrorists. Secretary Shultz is defending this thing, saying, yes, it will be necessary to take action on the basis of information that would never stand up in court, and yes, innocent people will be hurt in the process. This bill also provides for the Secretary of State to put together a list of terrorists, of suspected terrorists, of terrorist supporters.
Just on his own word.
And if your name or your organization is on the list, you would not be permitted to go to court and challenge it and have your name taken off the list. So the Secretary of State pins your name on his list, and legally they can kick in your door and kill you. They've got the teams put together. To do the preemptive striking, international SWAT teams.
The State Department and all have actually said who they claim in the United States are some of these terrorists. This includes people who are supportive of the freeze,
mm-hmm.
people who are against nuclear power plants.
Mm-hmm. CSPIS, this lobby group
people
on Central
America. Right, people who support the refugees coming up from El Salvador, anybody who is supportive who is non-supportive of the administration view of Central America, that's millions of people.
Another one is the NERP, the National Emergency Reaction Plan, that Reagan started working on shortly after he put, you know, set people up, streamlining the National Guard Command, so it can be called out more quickly in times of civil disorder, a la Kent State.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's FEMA. There's a lot of laws, and, you know, you can sort out 15, you can sort out others.
That includes executive orders, too.
Right. Yeah, executive orders is one way of coming up with a law. Bills passed through Congress is another way. Supreme Court decisions, another way. And all these things are happening. And then just the policy.
Frank Wilkinson, who was jailed for a year for refusing to cooperate with the House Un-American Activities Committee, he tells us about a shocking threat to our civil liberties.
Preventive detention wipes out the foundation of the whole criminal justice system in our country, which is based upon the concept of the presumption of innocence. In America, when you're charged with a crime, you're presumed innocent until the jury has found you guilty. For that reason, our Eighth Amendment gives you bail so you can defend yourself. Judges will deny bail in certain capital cases, possibly, or in cases where there's reason to believe a flight from the jurisdiction. But generally, you get bail. All right, Kennedy's bill provides that an arresting police officer or FBI agent on a non-capital, not even an injury case, but it could be any one of a number of what I call a civil disobedience type of statutes, recidivists who constantly protest nuclear power plants or civil rights actions, something like that, is arrested. And the arresting officer takes you before the judge for arraignment and says to the judge, Your Honor, I ask that you deny bail. This man or this woman is dangerous. That's the only word used. At that point, under Kennedy's bail, the judge locks you up for 5 days while you prove that you're not dangerous. And how do you prove you're not dangerous if you're already locked up allegedly on suspicion of violating some law? After 5 days, based on hearsay evidence, that would never be accepted in a court of law. The judge then can deny you bail, and you're locked up. You're locked up pending trial. It's an Alice in Wonderland type of justice, where the Queen of Hearts said, "Sentence now, trial later," whatever that was, you know, in the Lewis Hart book. And that is happening now. That is law now, and the horrible irony is that it's to be compared with something that's going on to uphold apartheid in South Africa.
These seem to be pretty serious things. Now, you have a historical perspective of what the United States has done in the Civil War and World War I, World War II. How does this stack up with things that have happened in the past?
It pales everything else. It's beyond everything else. If we go back to what American school children still hear about as an unfortunate thing in American history that was corrected, you know, and so that everything is okay ever since. The Third Alien Act of July 1798 provided that the President of the United States, in the event of a declared war, and the war would have been declared against France, the President then could arrest, imprison, and banish aliens from the homeland of the country with which the United States was making war. Okay, it had to be war declared, and the abuse, the disregard of the rights of aliens only from the country in belligerency. And it was never invoked. Nobody was touched by that action because of a storm of protest.
Now, Henry Gonzalez said that if there is a formal declaration of law, all of these acts, of war, that all of these acts, like the 1918 Sedition Act and the Espionage Act of 1917, they would automatically come back into effect.
I think he's in error. There were four major laws made during World War I. The two you mentioned, and then one called the Sabotage Act, which made it a crime against the war interests of the United States to stop working, which is to say, to participate in the strike.
Right.
And then there was a fourth, final, sweeping Alien Act, in which not just Germans, but any aliens could be put in jail if they were suspect, and chiefly suspect of anarchism. Now, I don't think those laws can be reinvoked. They weren't in World War II. That's why the Smith Act was written. But what we have here is a record of preparing for war by preparing to make a kind of war against our own people. In the U.S. Constitution, every alien has every protection that we citizens have. And these laws suspended that, and those laws have been held constitutional.
And this FEMA stuff isn't just against aliens, it's against everybody.
Anybody. Now, if you go down to the Smith Act of 1940, the Alien Registration Act, no time of war, all right? It's because of a situation in which war may become likely. Any alien of any nationality can be detained or deported for any suspicious action to the safety of the United States. That's getting more extreme, but at least the context is war is likely. Now we have, in 1940 there was not a politician in the United States who, when he thought of the word war in connection with the United States, did not assume a congressional debate and a vote to declare war. Now there isn't a politician who thinks that any such debate is plausible anymore. That's a great, regrettable change. The Emergency Detention Act of 1950, which is part of the so-called McCarran Act, absented the condition of war altogether. It was for an emergency to be declared by the presidency. Those emergencies included a declaration of war or invasion or insurrection of the United in the United States, or threat of insurrection in the United States, and then anybody, alien or naturalized, could be incarcerated on suspicion that that person would conspire to commit an act. So it's no overt acts even.
And the president could just declare the situation just on his own. He didn't have to get approval or anything.
Yes, right? The American president vetoed that act, and it passed over his veto. It has since been repealed in 1971, but for all we know, given the clandestine character of so many operations, it's incorporated into this present act for preparing for an emergency.
Well, even at that, there was a study made in the early 70s after the act was supposedly repealed, and the concentration camps which they'd set up were still in a caretaker status.
And some of those were the ones prepared for the Japanese, 120,000 Japanese Americans who were incarcerated during World War II. During World War I, there were severe measures, the Espionage Acts and the Sedition Acts, which didn't have anything to do with espionage. They had to do with criticism of the U.S. government.
And don't forget that there's plenty of precedent of the government jailing anti-war dissidents. 30,000 people jailed in the Civil War for protesting the war. 6,000 jailed in World War I for protesting the war. Remember Kate Richards O'Hare saying the women of the United States are nothing but brood sows producing sons to be put into the army to be turned into fertilizer, and she was sentenced to 5 years in jail for anti-war toll.
We do have to remember, in all justice and candor, that much of the repression which has occurred in this country has been popular. That is, the population has supported it, and it was assured by its government that it was justified and, in fact, necessary for the preservation of American values. And the American people have always rested uneasily with that. They've regretted each Red Scare, at least to some extent. But for a while, it's been popular, and the Constitution is there in part to protect those of us who are going to say something that our countrymen don't want to hear. We're supposed to be able to say it. And these government programs have been designed to crush us if we've tried.
And what's at stake is freedom, freedoms that we have sometimes inaccurately boasted about. But freedom, the system of democracy itself. There are cynical people in the world, including in this country, who are quite happy to take away your freedom if you'll let them do it. And this is what's at stake right now.
What the American people must never forget is that when fascism comes to America, it will come wrapped in an American flag. And that's something that I have never forgotten. Because that's the problem that we face today. And we have to be very open about this. What are we facing? We're facing the road to fascism. And when we understand that, millions and millions of American people will stand up and will fight for the elementary preservation of the American system of government.
And that brings us to the end of this Alternative Views. Frequently hear from viewers who request a list of news publications, which we use on Alternative Views, and also a reading list for U.S. power structure in the mass media. If you would like to have these, send a stamped, self-addressed envelope to the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. You must send a self-addressed stamped envelope. That same address is one which you can use to write us on any subject. As a matter of fact, Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. Goodbye.